Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. United States is calling for a vote Friday on a newly revised and tougher UN resolution declaring that an immediate sustained ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war is imperative to protect civilians and enable humanitarian aid to be delivered to more than 2 million hungry Palestinians. In the previous draft, the Security Council did not make such a declaration. Meanwhile, at a news conference, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. remains against Israel's plan for a ground offensive against Hamas and Rafah.
Military operation in Rafah would be a mistake, something we don't support, and it's also not necessary to deal with Hamas, which is necessary. We're going to have an opportunity next week to share in detail that view with our Israeli counterparts.
AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports that House Speaker Mike Johnson says he'll love to have Israel's prime minister address Congress amid growing criticism from Democrats.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says he plans to invite Israel's prime minister to address Congress. It would be a GOP show of support amid growing criticism from Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and other Democrats of Benjamin Netanyahu's leadership.
Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way.
Republicans have rallied around Netanyahu since. Johnson tells CNBC he'll invite Netanyahu to address Congress. Such a speech during the Hamas war would be seen as highly politicized by many Democrats critical of Netanyahu's war tactics. Schumer says he would welcome an address. Sagar Magani, Washington.
You'll find more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Four Central European countries remain deeply divided over how to resolve Russia's war against Ukraine. The foreign ministers said Thursday. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has details.
Foreign ministers from the Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, and Slovakia met Thursday to discuss a Czech plan to acquire ammunition that Ukraine badly needs from third countries outside the European Union. But the foreign ministers of Hungary and Slovakia said they are not ready to change the refusal to provide arms to Ukraine. This is Juraj Blanár, Slovak Minister of Foreign Affairs.
We have to fight for our national interest. As you might know, that Slovakia is very dependent on gas and nuclear fuel from the Russia.
Under the plan, the Czechs seek to obtain 800,000 artillery shells for Ukraine. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Lawmakers introduced a $1.2 trillion spending package Thursday that sets the stage for avoiding a partial government shutdown for several key federal agencies in the U.S. this weekend, and it allows Congress nearly 6 months into the budget year to complete its work for funding the government through September. Democrats were able to swat back scores of policy mandates and some of the steeper budget cuts that House Republicans were seeking. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports on a Trump fundraising appeal that focuses mainly on the former president's legal bills.
Donald Trump's new joint fundraising agreement with the Republican National Committee directs donations to his campaign and a political action committee that pays his legal bills before the RNC gets a cut. The diversion makes it more likely that Republican donors could see their money go to Trump's lawyers. They've already received at least $76 million over the last 2 years to defend him against four felony indictments and multiple civil cases. Trump has invited high-dollar donors to Palm Beach, Florida, for an April 6 fundraiser. I'm Norman Hall.
A federal judge has given prison terms of about 10 to 40 years to six white former Mississippi law enforcement officers who pleaded guilty to breaking into a home without a warrant and torturing two black men. The judge gave sentences near the top of federal guidelines to five of the six culprits. He sentenced the final two on Thursday. The six officers were fired and pleaded guilty to brutalizing Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker in January of last year. The so-called goon squad broke into a home where a neighbor complained that the black men were staying with a white woman. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
ceasefire in Gaza.
The teams are working every single day on this.
The U.S. government sues Apple, charging it with antitrust.
Apple has employed a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers.
And a little piece of Hiroshima in New York City.
Here in Manhattan, a unique witness to the fiery end of the Second World War, a statue from Hiroshima that saw the nuclear explosion now stands.
Today is Friday, March 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said on Thursday the gaps are narrowing in talks in Doha towards an agreement on the release of hostages and a ceasefire in Israel's conflict with Hamas in Gaza.
Over the last 2 days, in my travels to the region, we've met intensively with virtually all of our regional partners, from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, from Jordan, from the UAE, from Qatar, Palestinian Authority. But I very much appreciate the foreign minister hosting today's meeting with the Arab foreign ministers. I've been meeting and speaking individually to them over the past several weeks, but it was very good to be together, to have the opportunity to convene as a group, to share views on where we are, where we need to go, and how we can best get there.
On Israeli plans to initiate a ground offensive in Rafah, Blinken said the U.S. was still against it.
On Rafah, again, we've been very clear, President Biden's been very clear that a major ground operation in Rafah would be a mistake and something that we can't support. There is no place for the many civilians who are massed in Gaza, in Rafah, excuse me, to go to get out of harm's way. And for those that would inevitably remain, it would be a humanitarian disaster.
Blinken will be in Israel on Friday. The French ambassador to the United Nations on Thursday urged the Security Council to get a ceasefire resolution in Gaza before the end of the week.
The Security Council has been discussing this issue again and again. This crisis started more than 5 months ago. We need a ceasefire for Ramadan, and we are basically almost at the end of the second week of Ramadan.
Fighting continued on Thursday at the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza. That's Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari saying that Hamas and Islamic Jihad gunmen are holed up in the building at Al-Shifa Hospital in the emergency room. He said the army raid on the hospital was expected to go on for a few more days. Famine is imminent in northern Gaza, where 70% of people are experiencing catastrophic hunger, according to a report released this week by the International Community Authority on hunger severity, which warns that any escalation of the war could push half of Gaza's population to the brink of starvation. Bob Kitchen, Vice President of Emergencies at the International Rescue Committee, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that the humanitarian suffering in Gaza could be avoided if Israel would allow emergency supplies to get through at the border.
The data coming out from the UN is that more than half of the people in northern Gaza are already likely in the conditions that are used with the F word, famine. That two of the three criteria are probably met already, and that proportion decreases slightly as you go into the middle of the strip and then declines again as you get to the southern half where there's greatest access. And that's the key here, is humanitarian access, being able to deliver aid to the people who need it most urgently, where it is comparatively, it is not easy, but it is comparatively easy now to do that in Rafah. And then it becomes incrementally more difficult as you move further north.
Now, we've heard from a couple of U.S. congressmen that recently visited Rafah, right there along the border and where the trucks are being held up, and other people that are in that area, that there are just piles of trucks being held up. Is it possible, from what you have been told and what you can see there, that there can be more ease of and more flexibility in the way that this is being conducted over the border, so that more humanitarian aid can get into Gaza if Israel would allow it?
100%. I think we need to be clear here that normally when we see catastrophic food security, when we have seen twice in the last 12 years, previously famine, it is a combination of climate change, so underlying fragility that's driven by the change the climate has made to people's ability to farm and to harvest, and always compounded by conflict where access to markets, the delivery of aid, has compromised people's ability to survive. That is not the case in Gaza. There is no climate change dynamic. This is purely man-made. It is purely as a result of violence and intentional bureaucracy that is stopping the delivery of humanitarian aid. That is, if you've ever needed an example of life-saving, this is it, here and now, where there are millions of people on the brink of starvation because we can't get aid in. We can't get it in because of the constraints on those trucks lining up that have to be checked. Things are being pulled out. Trucks are being returned. And then once we're in, because of the bombing, because of the checkpoints, because of the violence, we can't take the trucks further north into Gaza.
Is it that critical now where you're saying starvation? Are people, children especially, are they dying from starvation?
We're on the brink of that. That's what the declaration of famine means, that the mortality rates, excess mortality rates, have risen to a degree where people are now dying because of hunger. Now, people rarely die because of hunger. It is complications that come associated with extreme hunger. It's when a human body is that hungry, it starts to close down. And then it's very exposed to waterborne diseases and other contagious diseases that, sadly, are also drastically on the rise in Gaza because there's not enough water. There's not enough power. There's not enough fuel to power the desalination plants so people have free access to clean water, which they did before the conflict. Again, man-made disaster. And because of the violence, the concentration of population from across the strip into the southern part, into Rafah, has led to massive overcrowding. So we have thousands of people trying to share individual toilets. So they're overflowing. People don't wait to use the toilets. They go elsewhere. And that turbocharges the risk to life through cholera or just diarrhea. People die because of dehydration.
That's Bob Kitchen, Vice President for Emergencies at the IRC, speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam in New York. We're following these other stories from around the world. Surgeons and researchers behind the first pig-to-human kidney transplant hailed it on Thursday as a major breakthrough that could benefit countless patients on dialysis or languishing on a transplant waiting list.
The size of the pig kidneys was exactly the same as human kidneys.
North Korea has sent a delegation to China, Vietnam, and Laos, according to state media KCNA on Friday. The isolated country is expanding its diplomatic engagement after COVID-19 lockdowns. Major airline chiefs plan to hold discussions with Boeing board chair Larry Kellner in meetings that will not include CEO David Calhoun, after raising concerns over an Alaska Airlines mid-air emergency and ongoing production issues. The European Union believes it can use windfall profits from frozen Russian assets to buy weapons and ammunition for Ukraine.
I told the leaders that if we are swift now in concluding the proposal, we could disburse the first billion on the 1st of July already.
The leaders' desire for urgency reflects increasing alarm about the war in Ukraine, with Kyiv's ammunition-starved forces struggling to hold back Russian troops and a $60 billion military aid package for Kyiv stuck in the U.S. Congress. The U.S. Department of Justice and 15 U.S. states on Thursday sued Apple as the government cracks down on big tech, alleging the iPhone maker monopolized the smartphone market, hurt smaller rivals, and drove up prices. Joining us now to talk about this is Jean A. Thomas, a partner in Crowell and Moring's antitrust and competition and privacy and cybersecurity groups, and co-chair of the firm's e-discovery and information management practice. So let's start by walking us through exactly what the government is alleging.
DOJ is alleging that Apple is unlawfully maintaining a monopoly in smartphones, in the iPhone market for the devices themselves, in which Apple has somewhere between a 65 to 70% share in the United States. And it's not unlawful under the antitrust laws for a company to have a monopoly. Sometimes companies, you know, gain a very significant market share because they provide really great products or services. And, you know, competitors are just not able to sustain the same market share. So it's really not about the fact that Apple has a big market share. What DOJ is alleging is that Apple is maintaining that market share through practices and policies that are specifically designed to exclude competition. And that if Apple were not engaging in those policies and practices, there would be more competition, there would be more innovation, Apple would have to compete to meet that competition, consumers would benefit because they'd have more innovative products and services available, they would be able to switch and make choices among various smartphone providers more easily. They would be less captive to Apple and what DOJ calls its walled garden. And that ultimately the prices of goods and services provided through Apple's iPhone ecosystem would be less.
So it's confusing because they're not the only smartphone maker. People could choose to use a different brand of phone, right?
Exactly. And so there, as the complaint alleges, that the smartphone market, and particularly the premium smartphone market, is really Apple with its very large share, and then Samsung would be number two and Google would be number three. So there are choices. But what DOJ is alleging is that Apple creates these policies and practices so that consumers are really beholden to the Apple ecosystem. So, for example, the complaint alleges that if you have a smart watch, like the Apple Watch or another watch, Apple makes it much easier for Apple's watch to interface and provide important features on the iPhone than with an Android system, for example. So that would be a reason that consumers, maybe if they liked the prices of another phone or for other reasons, they were thinking about switching to an Android ecosystem, they would say, well, yeah, but my smartwatch won't work as well and I'd have to buy a new watch. What the DOJ is arguing is that those types of making those sort of competitive alternatives available is possible for Apple. In fact, Apple may make more money in the short run if it's providing these services that consumers really want, but it's foregoing those short-term profits because it wants to make it difficult for consumers to leave the iPhone ecosystem. And therefore, that's protecting its monopoly in a way that crosses the line from an antitrust perspective.
Thank you so very much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Jean A. Thomas, a partner at Crowell & Mooring. The United Nations General Assembly on Thursday unanimously adopted the first global resolution on artificial intelligence to encourage protecting personal data, monitoring AI for risks, and safeguarding human rights. Here's U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
As President Biden was quoted as saying, this is a big bleeping deal. Today, all 193 members of the United Nations General Assembly have spoken in one voice and together chosen to govern artificial intelligence rather than let it govern us. The groundbreaking resolution adopted today cements global consensus for safe, secure, trustworthy AI systems, systems that both advance sustainable development and respect fundamental freedoms.
The resolution is the latest in a series of initiatives, few of which carry any teeth, by governments around the world to shape AI's development amid fears it could be used to disrupt democratic processes, turbocharge fraud, or lead to dramatic job losses, among other harms. International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Armed gangs are launching new attacks in the suburbs of Port-au-Prince, with heavy gunfire echoing across once peaceful communities near the Haitian capital. Associated Press journalists reported seeing at least five bodies in and around the suburbs, and gangs blocked entrances to some of those areas. While some Kenyans support President William Ruto's insistence on sending a police mission to Haiti, many others still wonder why their country wants to lead a multinational force aimed at helping quell violence and restore security, given that other nations that are more powerful and better equipped have not stepped forward. For more, let's go to VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief, Mariama Diallo.
Passions are running high in the streets of Nairobi over possibly deploying the country's police to Haiti.
Now, why are you sending police instead of sending military to for such a thing? That's my question.
It does nothing, because we're going to lose our beloved ones. Kenya, we don't have that power like the other countries, like the United States.
I think that's a noble idea, because we are human beings. Although people are complaining about the procedure which has been used.
Let me conclude my remarks.
President William Ruto, who recently signed a long-awaited bilateral accord with visiting Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry to pave the way for 1,000 Kenyan police officers to lead a proposed multinational UN-backed force that would help restore security in Haiti, insists it's the right thing to do.
It is a mission for humanity.
Attorney Ikuru Okot was among a group that filed a petition before Kenya's high court that argued sending the country's police to Haiti was unconstitutional. He says the recent signing was misleading.
First of all, it's a bogus agreement because it has no legitimacy, both in law and even on the person representing.
And there are still problems whether this mission will go on or not, because all the legal benchmarks have still not been satisfied, he says.
When Jovenel Moïse was killed in July 2021, Ariel Henry was only supposed to be in power for 120 days. For him to take over the role of a prime minister under the constitution of Haiti, he must be ratified, vetted by parliament. And approved by parliament. He was never.
George Musamali, a security consultant based in Nairobi, says it's time to rethink the Haitian issue.
What people have not focused on is the reason for this turmoil for all these years. Remember, we started talking about trouble in Haiti in 1805 when they first declared independence from the French.
There have been several unsuccessful interventions, including efforts by the United States and the United Nations.
With such a hostile and volatile situation now in Haiti, Musamali says it's hard to envision that a military or a police intervention would work. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And finally, following the Hollywood success of Christopher Nolan's biopic of Robert Oppenheimer, a more obscure but no less interesting memory from the atomic age can be found in Manhattan, not too far from one of Oppenheimer's boyhood homes. Evgeny Maslov has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, as he's often called, was born and raised in Manhattan, and lived for a time in New York City at 155 Riverside Drive. It is also here in Manhattan that a unique witness to the fiery end of the Second World War a statue from Hiroshima that saw the nuclear explosion now stands.
And the statue was facing the blast, and you can see the discolorization on the bottom here. That was from the blast itself.
The statue of Shinran Shonin, a Japanese Buddhist monk, was just about 2.5 kilometers away from the epicenter of the nuclear blast in Hiroshima. Moved to New York in the 1950s, it now stands as a symbol of world peace.
Late 40s, when they started forming the United Nations, Japan wanted to have an offering, a peace offering. And so people in Hiroshima thought it would be very spiritual and meaningful to send a statue of Shinran over to the UN. And that was its original purpose. So for logistic reasons, the UN could not utilize the statue, so the New York Buddhist Church accepted it.
Another coincidence places the New York Buddhist Church on Riverside Drive, on the same street Oppenheimer lived on.
In New York, we've gotten a lot of interest in the statue because of the release of the movie. And I think it's very poignant because I think it's a counterbalance, because areas that have trauma, there's a solidarity with people coming and experiencing the statue.
Rye adds that there is a certain symbolism in the closeness of the boyhood home of the father of the bomb, and one reminder of its deadly impact just blocks away. For Evgeny Maslov in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. You can also download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The pro-Beijing legislature in Hong Kong has passed new security laws under Article 23 of the Basic Law. International observers charge the new legislation will further silence opposition voices and further erode the autonomy Hong Kong was promised in 1997, when Britain handed over Hong Kong's governance to China. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel said the United States is alarmed by the sweeping and what we interpret as vaguely defined provisions laid out in the Article 23 legislation. The new laws were passed 20 years after similar legislation was attempted by pro-PRC authorities, but that attempt caused hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers to take to the streets in protest, and the legislation was withdrawn. In 2020, the PRC imposed the National Security Law, or NSL, on Hong Kong, resulting in the arrest and imprisonment of scores of democracy advocates, civil society activists, opposition political figures, as well as to the closure of independent media outlets. Estimates are that some 500,000 people have left Hong Kong since the NSL was imposed. The U.S. Consulate General in Hong Kong keeps a tally it called bearing witness. According to the consulate, since the NSL went into effect, 237 people have been arrested for national security offenses. 135 people and organizations have been formally charged with national security crimes, and 90 people have been found guilty as of February 29, 2024. Now, with the new Article 23 legislation, authorities have another, even more wide-ranging weapon to wield against dissent. Principal Deputy Secretary Patel told reporters this was fast-tracked through the non-democratically elected Legislative Council after a truncated public comment period.
We also believe that a lot of the phrasing and crimes that are outlined are poorly defined and incredibly vague. They use phrases such as external interference, which is incredibly vague. So we're analyzing this legislation, and we are taking a look at what the potential risk could be to not just U.S. citizens, but other American interests that we might have.
We're not going to hesitate to call out those responsible for the erosion of Hong Kong's promised autonomy, spokesperson Patel declared. And the United States, he added, will not hesitate to use other actions at its disposal should circumstances require it.
That was an editorial.